Obviously, I never said so, but you probably figured out that the last talk is very much autobiographical. It's the story of how I ended up being interested in Torah. I don't believe that there are these things. No, I've got it. Thank you very much. These single moments of epiphany where, like, that's the magic moment that changed your life. I don't believe in such a thing. I think that there's thousands of moments and decisions that goes into a person making this very slow curve in life. And I think it's the media's influence on us that makes us want to look for that magic moment, but I don't think they really exist. However, I thought maybe tonight I would share one other of these minuscule epiphanies that I had, which had an effect on me in a completely different way. When I was a sophomore at UCLA, I was shown a film which I found very disturbing. The film is a live Super 8 movie shot of a psych experiment that was conducted at Yale in the 1950s. If you're an undergraduate student in psychology at most fine undergraduate institutions, you're required as part of your degree to participate in psych experiments. So when I was at UCLA, we had to participate in psych experiments. At Harvard, they had the same rule. The thing is, at UCLA and Harvard, they had a rule that the psych professor was not allowed to hurt you. At Yale, they had no such rule. So what happened was, Dr. Stan Milgram, a very famous psychologist researching the causes of the Holocaust, would walk into this waiting room of students wearing his white coat, and he would say, you and you, come with me now. He would take two students out of the room, walk them down a hallway into this laboratory, take them into the laboratory. He would tell one of the students, have a seat. That student would sit down. He would strap the student's arms down onto armrests. Then with the student strapped into place, he would place a little bit of electroconductive jelly on the top of each palm, slap an electrode on each palm, put a little bit of electroconductive jelly on the man's forehead, slap an electrode onto his forehead. Then he would pull a microphone up in front of this poor kid and say, if you need to speak to us, you can speak to us through this microphone. We'll talk to you through that speaker on the wall. And then he would grab the other student and leave this poor fellow strapped into the chair. He took the other student down the hallway to another laboratory. In this laboratory, sitting on the desk, there was a massive electric shock generator. Over the first switch, it said 15V. The second switch said 30V, 45V, 60V, going straight up through 400V. He would have the second student sit down here. He pulled a microphone up in front of the second student, and he said, if you want to speak to your friend, you can speak to your friend through this microphone. He'll hear you. And if you want to hear him, just listen to that speaker on the wall. He explained, what we're going to do is we're going to test your friend to see how well he can memorize word pairs. Then Milgram took this sheet filled with word pairs, put it in front of this fellow, and said, make sure your friend can hear you. Read him a word pair. Check with me. Each time I'll tell you, you should read the next word pair. After a certain number of word pairs, I'll stop you, and then I want you to test him and see how he does. If he makes a mistake, you give him a shock. So when the experiment begins, you see the video. It's the movie of the thing actually happening. One of the students pulls over the microphone and says, hello, can you hear me? And you hear his friend down the hall saying, yeah, I can hear you. He says, listen, Dr. Milgram wants me to read you some word pairs. Okay, try to memorize these. Okay. Dog, cat, table, chair, fork, knife. Okay, Dr. Milgram says that we should stop here. These are three word pairs. I'm going to read you the first word now. You try to say the second word, okay? And you hear the guy saying over the speaker, okay. Dog. And you hear the sound coming from the speaker. Cat. He says, good. You got it right. Okay, here we go. Table. Hear the guy in the other room saying table. Chair. He says, oh, very, very good. Okay, last one. Here we go. Fork. Hear the guy in the other room saying fork. Fork is plate. Milgram tells this guy, throw the first switch. You watch on the video, the guy reaches over, he flips the first switch, and as he flips the first switch, you hear, "Ow! I just got a shock!" Milgram says, read in the next three word pairs. And so the game continues, and every time the guy makes a mistake, Milgram instructs the student to throw the next switch. In Milgram's book, called Obedience to Authority, which is available in any good academic library, Milgram writes that the sound coming over the speaker at around 75 volts can only be described as a continuous, agonized scream. Around 150 volts, between 150 and 400, the voice coming over the speaker from the other room goes silent. Because the man in the other room is dead. Now, the only thing the guy throwing the switches doesn't know is the fellow strapped in the chair in the other room is not a student at all. The guy strapped in the chair in the other room is an actor on Milgram's staff. And he's not receiving any electric shocks at all. He's just watching lights flash so he knows how loud to scream. And the whole focus of the experiment is this fellow, this ordinary Yale student, psych student, and the goal is to find out how far would an ordinary human being go in causing terrible pain or death to another human being as long as somebody else accepts responsibility. Milgram standing there in the white coat saying, throw the next switch. Okay. In the first run of Milgram's experiment, the total percentage of people who refused to throw the first switch was zero. And the number of people who were willing to go all the way until the voice went silent was 66%. So Milgram felt, I've explained the Holocaust. There was nothing in the water in Poland. It's not that Germany went crazy. It's that these are human beings, and ordinary, normal human beings will become a cog in a horrific machine as long as somebody else takes responsibility. Milgram's colleagues objected, and they said, your experiment is fatally flawed. Obviously, there's some sort of sample bias. It must be that there's something about the Yale Psych Department admissions policy that selects for sadists. So, in order to prove that he was not mistaken, so Milgram reran the experiment, this time with all Yale undergrads, then reran it again, this time with Yale staff and students, then reran it again with blue-collar and white-collar workers in the Connecticut area. Here you have to change the experiment a little bit. How do you get them to participate? Milgram paid them a sum of money to participate in the experiment, but he paid them before they ever entered into the experiment. So they already had cash in pocket, and he told them, anytime you want, you can leave. Then he ran the experiment. In all of these runs of the experiment, the total percentage of people who refused to throw the first switch was always zero. Everyone cooperated at the beginning. As the screams got louder and louder and louder, he usually lost about a third of his participants. About 66 to 70% went all the way every single time. Now the truth is, watching the film alone did not make me crazy. What really disturbed me and what I mean really struck to the core of my personality, really hurt very much, was there was a final run of the Milgram experiment that was done before Milgram was arrested. Milgram actually spent time in jail because a bunch of people who had participated in his psych experiment afterwards, when they realized they were potentially murderers, they needed psychological counseling to deal with this fact. So they sued him in a class action suit. And the experiment was actually banned in Connecticut, and then they moved it to California, of course. And then they banned it in California. Now it's illegal in the United States. You cannot perform the Milgram experiment anywhere in the United States. I don't know if it's legal in England or not, but you can't perform this experiment in the United States anymore. However, before he was arrested, what happened was Milgram and his genius, I mean, he was an amazing, amazing researcher. He came up with a version of the experiment which really gave me the chills. Milgram crafted a questionnaire with 100 questions about values in it. And he inserted into this questionnaire the question, would you ever, as part of a psych experiment, give electric shocks to a perfectly innocent human being? Okay. He distributed this questionnaire to Yale staff, students, other universities. He did it to blue-collar and white-collar workers. The total percentage of students who said that they would never, ever give an electric shock to a totally innocent human being as part of a psych experiment, the percentage of people who said that was 100. There was not a single person who said they would ever give an electric shock as part of a psych experiment. Then, Milgram waited 6 months and summons these very people to participate in his experiment. Now, they didn't know what they were coming to do. But when they arrived, he had his actor strapped into the chair, took the other fellow into the other room, and he ran the whole experiment. Of these people who had said that they would never, ever give an electric shock to a completely innocent human being, the total percentage who refused to throw the first switch was zero. And the percentage that went all the way was hovering around 70%. So I walked out of that classroom, and you know what I was thinking. I was thinking, Kellerman, is this you? And I can't say, well, I would never do such a thing, because that's what they all said. Milgram writes in his book, you, who condemned the subjects, sitting comfortably in your armchairs, who condemned the subjects, are holding them to an unfair standard. For they too said they would never do such a thing until they were under the pressure of circumstances where they failed to realize their values. So I remember walking out, being very disturbed, and for about 4 years, I don't think this is too strong a word, I obsessed over that experiment. Wondering, is this me? Or to say it in other words, I know what the symptoms of evil look like when they bubble up to the surface. I know what rape looks like. I know what murder looks like. I know what robbery looks like. But I'm not so naive as to believe that a perfectly fine human being one day becomes a rapist, a robber, or a murderer. I understand that there are roots of evil, and that you wait till the opportunity presents itself, and then the murderer, when the opportunity presents itself, actually shows that he's a murderer. But he was essentially a murderer before that moment. Just the opportunity wasn't there until that moment. The circumstances that pushed him over the edge weren't there. But he was essentially a murderer, just waiting for the right circumstances. If I had to explain what bothered me, I know what the symptoms of evil look like, but what are the roots of evil? And if I could just identify that, I could look in a mirror and know, is that me? Four years later, I stumbled into yeshiva. And in yeshiva, I was learning a book, the Jewish prayer book, with the commentary of a fellow that they just call the genius of Vilna, the Vilna Gaon, written a little less than a couple hundred years ago. I didn't read any Hebrew. I was raised with basically no background. And I stumbled in there basically to do sociological research. I wasn't terribly interested in becoming religious, but I found their text fascinating. There's a high school student who's teaching me this book. The kid was probably about 15 years old. And he used to learn it with me 1 hour a day. And we had gotten up to the place in the prayer book where there's a prayer these Orthodox Jews say every day about evil people. And in that prayer, V'lamal Shinim, about evil people, the Vilna Gaon asks the following question. Genius of Vilna asks the following question. He says, Ma hu shorish Russia. What is the root of an evil person? That was the end of our hour. The kid closes the book and says, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. At which point I flipped the book open and said, no, we'll talk about it now. I've been waiting 4 years for this. And I didn't really believe I was going to get a good answer. Because when you sit on a question for 4 years, you can't really believe there's a good answer out there. I had no idea. I was blown away by the answer. It changed my whole life, this answer. He says something amazing there. He says, if when you're looking for evil people, you go around looking for sadists who get up in the morning and say, I'd like to hurt somebody today, you're going to miss out on 99.5% of the evil people on the planet. Right? Most people in Germany weren't like that. Tell me something. Where were the most refined people on the planet in 1925? Yeah. Without a doubt. If you're looking for crazy people, you're never going to find most of the evil people on the planet. He says, you're looking for the wrong thing. If you want to find something that's evil, don't look for that. What do you look for? He quotes a verse from Isaiah. An evil person is like a storming sea. So what does he mean it's like a storming sea? My father, he should live and be well, he spent many, many years as a deep sea fisherman. And I spent many months on the Pacific Ocean with my father fishing for tuna. I actually hate fishing, but I love my father, so I went.
And I get really seasick, but okay, I learned to take the drugs. So when I would go out with my dad, at 9, 10, 11 in the morning, most days, it was gorgeous. So the sea was like glass. Around 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, this is off the Baja coast, so the wind starts to whip up. And when the wind starts to whip up, I mean, just light winds, already the waves start to undulate. And as the wind becomes stronger and stronger, the waves become bigger and bigger, because the nature of the sea is it can't hold itself back. As the wind blows, it blows with the wind. The Vilna Gaon there says, the nature of an evil person is he's like a storming sea. What does that mean? He can't hold himself back when the wind blows. Or another way of saying that is, he's affected by his environment. This is absolute genius. Evil people aren't mean. They're just people who are flexible. They move with the wind, and as long as the wind is blowing in the right direction, they look perfectly righteous. But if the wind, God forbid, flips and blows in the other direction, because they're affected by their environment, they blow in that direction as well. The essence of what it means to be evil is that whatever's going on around me, that's where I go. That I don't have an anchor. What would be the exact opposite of an evil person? So there's this amazing medrash, passage in the oral tradition, Jewish oral tradition, that tells the following story. Once upon a time, there was a man by the name of Abraham. Abraham's father ran an idol factory and had an idol warehouse where people used to come and buy idols. One day, Abraham's father says to Abraham, you know, listen, your mom and I haven't had a vacation in years. We'd like to go away. We're going to go to Hawaii. Could you watch the store? And Abe says, mom and dad, not a worry. Go ahead. Right? Mom and dad get all packed up. The taxi pulls up. They hop in. They wave. They take off. When they disappear over the horizon, Abraham takes an axe, goes into the idol warehouse where all the most expensive stuff is, takes his axe, and he starts swinging. And he blows all these idols to pieces. He leaves the room with 3 feet of rubble and nothing else other than a wooden Indian he left standing in the corner. He takes the axe, he puts it into the hand of the wooden Indian, and he waits for his parents to come home. The taxi pulls up. Dad gets out wearing the sunglasses, the Bermuda shorts. Yeah, he walks over to the front door. He opens up the front door. As he opens up the front door, 3 feet of rubble pours out onto Abraham's father's feet. He looks up. And he looks around the room and he sees the rubble and he says, oh my gods! What happened here? On the spot, Abe says, Dad, it was terrible. The wooden Indian, he went wild. Abraham's father grabs Abraham and says, kid, what are you talking about? That's a block of wood. He can't do anything. What did you do? Abraham says to his father, Dad, if that's just a block of wood, how can you sell it as a god? So Abraham's father blows a fuse, grabs the kids, you don't like idols, come with me. And he drags him off, right, to Nimrod, the king of the whole area, throws him on the floor and says to Nimrod, who's a big idol worshiper, my kid doesn't like idols, you want to have a word with him? Nimrod says, Abe, stand up. There's no reason for violence. Let's have a talk. Would you like to worship this rock right now? If not, I have a furnace I can throw you into. So Abraham says, you know, listen, furnace, rock, rock's looking pretty good. So Nimrod says, great, on the count of three, we're going to bow to the rock. And then you'll walk out of here perfectly fine, no damage done. You ready? Here we go. Nimrod says, 1, 2. Abraham says, wait. Nimrod says, boy, you mess with me, you're going to die. He says, no, I was just thinking, why are we bowing to the rock? Yeah? We should be bowing to the clouds because the rain comes down from the clouds and the rain can dissolve the rock. So the clouds are obviously more powerful than the rock. Let's bow to the clouds. Boy, you're Jewish, you're smart. He says, yeah, I'm thinking, let's bow to the clouds. He says, okay, fine, we'll bow to the clouds. Here we go. Okay, on the count of three. Here we go, Abe. Ready? Right? Clouds right over there. Here we go. 1, 2. Abraham says, wait! Boy, you mess me, you're going to die. He says, no, I was just thinking. Why are we bowing to the clouds? We really should be bowing to the wind that blows the clouds. Look, the wind is coming from the north. Let's bow to the north. Yeah, that looks really good. You going to bow? Yeah, look, the wind's right over there. Let's go. Okay, here we go. 1, 2. Abraham says, wait! Why are we bowing to the wind? We should be bowing to the God, the one God who makes the wind blow. Nimrod says, you going to die. He takes him. He throws him into the furnace. As Abraham's flying towards the furnace, the verses in the Song of Songs pick up. And the verse there says, we have a little sister. The Medrash says, this is Abraham, Why is he being described as a little sister? B'shadayim ein la. She's not fully developed. She's missing something. She's not fully developed. Shadayim ein la. She's missing breasts. What's going on here? The next verse says, Ma naseh lachoseinu b'yom shidu barba. What should we do on the day when she's spoken about? The Midrash says, this is the day when God decided to throw Abraham into the furnace, right? Or bow to the idol, one or the other. Im delethi, if she will be like a door. In those days, all doors were like barroom doors. They would swing back and forth. Whichever way you push them, they would move. The Midrash says, if Abraham will move his values around like a swinging door, then he will rot away like wood. He will pass out of existence. He'll be a flash in history. No one will have ever heard of him. And the next verse says, V'im choma he. But if this little girl will be like a wall, the Midrash says, if Abraham will stand up his values like a wall, that he will be impermeable. He will not move. No matter how much it hurts, no matter how much stress he's under, he will say, this is what I stand for, and period. Then we will build upon him turrets of silver. The Midrash says, he'll become a great leader. He'll have students. He'll have children who will follow in his way. And he will ultimately transform mankind. And the last line there says, as Abraham is flying towards the furnace, it's a quote of Abraham screaming, Ani choma! I'm a wall, and my breasts are like towers. What does that verse mean? It means if you want to nurse the next generation, if you want to create people with integrity, you have to be a person who does not move. That you have your values. And no matter how much stress you're under, no matter how much embarrassment, no matter how much difficulty, you stand for whatever you stand for. There's different kinds of wind. A man with epaulet says, join the party or die. Or it could be as simple as, I have a terrible headache or I'm very hungry. How can I smile and be nice to the person sitting next to me if I'm not feeling well? There's internal wind. There's external wind. The question is, what does that do to my ideal of how I think I should live and how I think I should appear and how I think I should be? Am I affected by my environment? You have on one hand the storming sea and you have on the other hand the wall. And the message of this Midrash is, if you're going to be a leader, if you're going to affect people, then you can't be moved by wind. Not that you can't be interactive. You can't accept from others. You can't take into account new circumstances. But you never give up your values, and you never stop living by them. No matter what happens to you, if you think about it, every leader who you admire is someone who had absolute faith. There were people who were absolutely solid. Nothing would move them. Doesn't make a difference if you're talking about a Gandhi or a Churchill. Doesn't make any difference if you're talking about a Kennedy. Whoever it is, these are people who they do not move. A Moses, an Abraham. That's what was great about them. I believe that there's spooky reasons why this is true as well, but simply psychologically. If when the wind hits, I move, I'll never affect anybody because I'm busy being affected. I just become like all those around me. But if I don't bend, then eventually the whole society will have to bend to me because I'm not moving. So when it runs into me at 180 kilometers per hour, it gets a dent, not me. For whatever reasons, I decided I was going to become a religious Jew. So you know what that means? That means that sometimes I'm surrounded by a group of completely secular people and I get up and I make a blessing. And they look at me like, you're crazy. Or I put on tefillin in the middle of an airport. Or on an airplane, sitting next to some guy who's staring at me as I'm putting on the tefillin. Dot, dot, dot. Put yourself in some of these situations. How would you respond? I have a test which eventually gave me peace of mind. A test to see how I would respond in the Milgram experiment. The test works virtually instantly. And you can see how you would respond in the Milgram experiment. And then, if you use the test often enough, you can actually build your ability to respond properly. And if you didn't respond properly the first time, after several months, you can actually start to respond properly. I will not tell you because I'm a little bit embarrassed how I responded the first time I took the test. The test is based on a diet that was practiced at least 1,000 years ago. It's written up in the works of a great scholar, contemporary of Maimonides, by the name of Arrivet. The diet works as follows. When you're eating, you can eat anything that you want. It's a great diet, anything that you want. And as much as you want to eat. But when you're done eating, you must leave. There's actually three versions of this diet, right? Small, medium, and large. I'll start with small, the beginner's version. You must leave on the plate one piece of completely edible food about the size of the end of your thumb. Just a piece, but something, not like the burnt piece of the hamburger, but like, you know, something that's like really edible. Why is that difficult? So if you listen carefully, when you're sitting there with a plate, with a bunch of food on the plate, if you listen carefully, you'll hear the food calling out to you.
Eat me.
Now, how long can you stare at a plate and resist that kind of wind? Now, I admit, this is lightning. It's not a hurricane. A guy who says, join the party or die, that's a hurricane. A man in a white coat who says, you throw the next switch or I fail you in the class, that's a hurricane. We're talking about just a little piece of food on a plate. If I can't withstand the wind that's blowing from a little piece of food on a plate, for sure I'm going to fail when the party takes power. In the simplest version of this experiment, what you do is, for 2 weeks, 14 consecutive days, every time you eat or drink, you leave one piece of food on the plate and a little bit of liquid in the cup. Every single time you eat or drink. If, on the 13th day, you forget, and the plate gets the best of you, and you end up eating also that little piece, not a problem. Just start from day one to another 14 days. Once you've got 14 consecutive days, you want to flex your muscles a little bit? Try this. Go up to step two. Step two is leave a little bit of each type of food on the plate. So if you had a hamburger and some salad and some chips, so you leave a chip that big, a little bit of hamburger that much, and a little piece of salad that big. A little bit of liquid in the cup. Do this every single time you eat or drink until you have 14 consecutive days of stage two. Right? I'm sure this will be no problem for you whatsoever. Now go ahead and try stage three. Stage three is as follows. In stage three, I admit, is difficult. True, the stage one is difficult. Stage three is near impossible. Stage three is something which is called best bite. What is best bite? Do you ever eat grilled cheese sandwiches? Okay, you know how sometimes when you make a grilled cheese sandwich, the cheese rolls over the corner and it's like crunchy right there? That's best bite, yes? Or you have a piece of cream cake. You have white cream cake, and plopped right in the middle of your slice of white cream cake, there is a bright red strawberry with a beautiful sugary glaze around it. Yeah? That strawberry is called best bite. Yeah? Okay. What you do is you have to leave best bite of each type of food that you ate. Okay, now, guaranteed you are not going to starve as a result of this. I've never had anyone go to a hospital as a result of keeping this diet. You can take as many plates of food as you want. The only thing that you can't do is finish off your plate entirely and then just put some extra on so you can walk away and leave it there. Yeah? That you can't do. And of course, if you can't keep this diet for 14 days, let's not fool ourselves into thinking that we would have remained righteous people in Auschwitz for a month or 6 or 2 years. And if that's the case, then what you may want to do is, like anyone who wants to run a marathon, start off with little tiny exercises, practice this diet until you've got 2 weeks consecutive, 2 weeks consecutive, 2 weeks consecutive. Then, once you can stand up to that sort of wind, by then I'll be back, it'll be a year already, and I'll come back and I'll give you the next exercise. Okay, I've got it right. Have a good evening. Yeah.